Blog Talk Radio.
Previously on episode 3001.
That was that. I didn't rush to TV and do it, start following it. But by August, September, they reran them. And for some reason, I decided to watch it. Maybe I was just hearing about it more and more. So I watched the first episode. And when Dale Cooper says, "What I really want to know is, what does Marilyn Monroe have to do with JFK?" Do you remember that statement?
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the beginning of the sort of the interesting angle. And I said, wow, I know all about that. And I said, what is this? So I started watching it, and it just, the synchronicity with me, which I call synchrony, just went on every week. And so I said, shit, I got to talk about this on the show. So I reviewed whatever that first 8 weeks was that they replayed in the summer. So I caught up in the summer. So my commentary is during the replay of the first season, so to speak. And then after that, I was up with everybody else following it through the whole, till the end. And, yeah, that's when I did commentary. And in 93, let me see. Jerry Fialka used to get audio tapes from another guy named George who would tape the show, and he'd send copies of the Mike Dyer Bob Show. And there was, so all that David Lynch commentary.
And that is where we got cut off 2 weeks ago. For anyone listening, Bob and I got cut off about a half hour ago. So we're working around some different things here with the technical glitches we had with the new episode 3001 show. One of the things I'm doing, and this is a plug, it's called CallGraph. And what it is it's a Skype recorder that I'm going to start using for all my shows just to make sure that if anything goes wrong on the Blog Talk Radio side of things, I'm going to have a copy of the show through the Skype recorder. And I've listened to a couple test subjects, and it works really well. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Greg. I'm just eating something. Okay.
Greg.
We're back. I was just the reason I called you Greg is Greg just had a session with Ion a couple hours ago, and I was in this break. I went up and mega upload him a copy of the reading for, you know, for his listening review, and so I had Greg in my mind, and I just came down and started talking to you. So sorry.
No harm, no foul.
Okay.
So how do you like that new that bit I did? It has a little Lost feeling to it. Do you like that?
It was perfect. I loved it. Previously on Bob's Android Me. Yeah, so we're going ahead. Here we got an hour at least, right?
We got 56 minutes.
Okay. So we were going to go back to your sleep paralysis, but let's finish this point about David Lynch. So I'm not
let's
sure.
Let's finish up the Lynch, and then we'll do the sleep paralysis, and then if we have time, we'll work on the Simon Monjack thing.
Right. As a matter of fact, we can do the Simon Monjack before the sleep if you want to. But
okay.
So Jerry, I guess it got on recording. Oh, there's a little mongoose walking along my patio. Neat little mongoose. Then there's little newts and things. I forget the lizard things. I forget their name. I see them all the time walking, running around here.
Gingriches.
What?
Gingriches?
No, geckos.
Geckos.
They're called geckos. So, you know, you see them on the window, and they're just sitting there on the window for hours waiting to stick their tongue out and get a mosquito or a fly or something. They just wait, and you watch them, and the tongue lashes out and gets something. Right? You remember that stuff when you lived in that level?
I've never seen a gecko, but I take your the only gecko I've seen is the one on the commercials, the talks.
Right, right. And wasn't that the name of the Michael Douglas character in Greed
Wall
or
Street.
Wall Street? Yeah, Wall
yes,
Street.
It was.
Wasn't he gecko?
He was gecko.
So, yeah. So they're just little lizards. But without repeating too much, I show up on February 15th, 1993, to hang out with Jerry, Carol, and I for 6 months before we go to New York to do the Mirror thing. And He has a friend who had been staying with him who went through all the cassette tapes. He had received copies of my show with Mike Dyer in the 90-91 period. And he'd put together all the Lynch parts and made this nice cassette. I don't know if it was one or two. So they had gone to the gallery on February 11th in the Santa Monica area where Lynch had some paintings or some show. And they gave him the tape. And we never heard back. We don't know if he listened to my commentary or what. But I remember I started going into this part, you know, half an hour ago. You remember a few years ago on YouTube or someplace, you could see these little filmed vignettes, videotaped vignettes of Lynch talking casually to somebody? Did you see those?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, remember he demonstrated cooking quinoa, K-U-I-N-O-A.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a good I just watched that last week, actually.
Oh, there you go. See, tuned in. Because yeah. for the first time you watched that?
Yeah, because a buddy of mine told me about it, and he for some reason, it rubbed him wrong. So I had to see it. So I made him watch
it
with me again. And and he didn't mind it so much the second time.
By after you talked to him about it, or just his own second viewing?
This is his own second viewing. After we watched it together, I think he realized he had to see it with a friend to have a good time with it.
Yeah, it's a private, intimate thing. You know, you're in the kitchen with David Lynch and he's cooking, and sort of like you're with your friend in a domestic situation, so it fits the mood if you're with somebody watching it.
Right, right.
It's like he's like cooking for you and your friend. I haven't seen it in years, but I thought it was a perfect description of how he makes his movies. I think he consciously meant that as a metaphor of how he did his stuff. I don't remember. I remember he was very careful, methodical, like, okay, this is a spoon. I'm going to place it in the direction towards the pot so that it touches the water. Then I move my wrist and it starts to circle, and that stirs up the water. We let it boil by going over here and put my hand on a little dial, and I turn that dial to 40, and that'll make the heat go through the element, and then that'll heat the pan, and then miraculously, shortly thereafter, the water is boiling. Do you remember that? It was like ridiculous.
Yeah, it's step great.
By
yeah,
step
it's
detail.
So, yeah, like simple, stupid. You know, like
yeah, simple. Okay, now I'm going to take the spoon out of the pot after I've stirred it and place it over here, being careful not to put it on something that'll burn. Then I'm going to walk over here and see this chair. I'm going to sit in it. Okay, I'm sitting down in the chair now.
the thing that blew me away most about the whole thing is that he's like, I'm going to take this paper towel and unfold it into quarters because the pot handle gets very hot and I don't want to burn my hand. And all I could think of is this. David Lynch must be like a multimillionaire, and he can't afford a pot holder.
Or he lives in the past. He likes to do it the way he did it when he was poor, when he was making a razor head 40 years ago. You know what I mean?
That could be. He likes that simplicity.
Like, so he, it's very, you can't tell whether he's putting it on or not.
Like you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, yes. He's a manipulator. But I don't think he is. I think he is like an idiot savant. He's a cinema savant.
Yeah, he is he's so down home and so down to earth, and yet he's like so in tune with like the, well, I guess you call
the
it the non-physical. You know,
no,
we talked about
fringe behavior, eccentric behavior, individual eccentric people, or just fringe people, the underbelly. That's what's lovely about his movies. He presents his whole theme of borderline people, you know, living in strange places. I mean, I always loved the home. I think I've said this before. The home in Blue Velvet, where they go and there's, was it Dean Stockwell? He's the,
yeah,
you know, like the,
yeah.
Dean Stockwell and Dennis Hopper sings the great Roy Orbison song there. And there's these two chunky old women in the background. That reminds me so much of being at Garrett's house. That is Garrett's reality. And, you know, that was my reality in the 60s and early 70s. And when I saw that, I said, holy shit, this guy is picking up on Bob reality. You know, that's...
And for those who don't know, Garrett was kind of like your mentor in a way.
Yeah, he was my...
Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah. He was my... You know, in the 10 Holy Offices on the album, he's under the category of personal, and that means your personal mentor, someone that everybody should have, somebody they meet that gives them attention or something, or is just unique. You know, you have to have that one-on-one experience with somebody.
Right, right, like this.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's a mentor. And, you know, there's so, Carolyn was saying the other day, there's a bit of Garrett in Ion's rants. It's very interesting, you know.
I noticed that because I listened to the Garrett stuff, and he has that kind of effeminate Southern gentleman vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though wasn't he from Newfoundland or was he from Halifax?
He's from Nova Scotia. He grew up in the wilderness, the country part around Pictou County, the farm area of Nova Scotia.
But the two recordings I've heard, one of when Ion was on this show, and then the whatever happened to Furry Lynn.
Not Ion, you mean Garrett. You don't mean
Garrett.
Not Ion, you mean Garrett. Yeah, he's on.
No, I'm comparing the two are very similar, is what I was saying. I noticed that when I listened to the Furry Lint, and then the when Ion was on, it reminded me of the Furry Lint recording.
No, that's really good. That's what Carolyn was noticing the other day. You see, it's interesting. Ion says, like, Ion doesn't. It's non-physical. It doesn't create. It's just in a blissed-out state. It doesn't create. No contrast. So the language and concepts it expresses, he gets from us. It's just you, he says, we're just using your words. So there could, if Ion, since I'm the major interactor with it, me and Carolyn, there may be a lot of my reality in Ion. You know what I mean? That my being. And so that's why if people knew a lot of my stuff and then listened to Ion and knew about Garrett and McLuhan and Zappa and all these things, they would say, wow, that's Bob. That's like Ion is largely an extension of Bob, but I know he's not limited to that because he becomes whoever he's talking to. It's just that I have to ask Ion how much he's limited by interacting with me. So the question would be, if Reverend Stang first was the first to encounter or evoke Ion, what would it be a different Ion? Do you know what I mean? A different personality vibration, even though Ion doesn't have a personality, but definitely comes through in the word something.
He probably comes through as a complete and total fucking asshole.
He wouldn't give readings. He'd say, you're fucking too stupid to have a reading. All he'd go is, send $30. Send $30. It'd just be recording. Send $30. Send $30.
And then he'd cling to that. I was doing this 30 years ago. What you're doing now, I was doing 30 years ago.
Yeah, the Ion would say, you humans, you just ripped me off. Everything you do, I did back in eternity, back in the Garden of Eden. We did all this stuff. We had 5,000 radio shows going at the same time, and we played all this shit. You guys are just ripping us off. That's a good one, Kirk. That's one of our best Stang satires we've done. Very
Thank
good.
So,
So and they're so stupid. They can't even, if they heard this, they wouldn't even understand it. They just think we were babbling in a foreign language or something. They can't get it.
I'm pandering to you, Bob. This whole show is.
You're pandering.
This whole show is. Kurt Weller giving Bob another fucking rim job. That's all they are here.
They don't understand camaraderie. I mean, I just enjoy talking to you because you have similar interests and you know a bit about what I'm doing. That's all it is. It's just
time.
I do this.
It's a good fucking time.
Yeah, yeah.
You
and
know,
I do
more,
this.
If more kids in the inner city did this kind of shit, there wouldn't be so much drug abuse and
you mean did what shit? Did me? Or
yeah,
just
talking
to
had a guy like Bob as your big brother or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
You know, problems in the world. The world would be perfect.
Yeah, they need a mentor. That's what you mean. The kids need a mentor. And that's really what education was. Originally, education was just a one-on-one thing. So Garrett was beautiful, and I really think it's great that you pick up Garrett in there. That means you're a good student of Dobbstown or a good co-creator of Dobbstown. You're picking up what Carolyn thought. You know, and Carolyn's been there from the beginning. And she had the same thought. Hey, this is like Garrett.
I'm kind of like a teacher's assistant, maybe.
Yeah. That's what you are. You're an assistant professor. You're an adjunct.
TA.
You're an adjunct.
Yeah, there you go.
You know that term? They call it adjunct on the East Coast, New York colleges. That's what people would say. I'm an adjunct at New York City or something. Do you know that term in college, adjunct?
We always call them TAs, but yeah, that it's the same thing pretty much.
Yeah,
like it's,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so it'd be great if you could quickly play, you can't right now, but if you could play Garrett going, Bobby, when the mothers had lovers, and when the cows could eat and the flowers. You remember that whole rant he does? It's really good.
Yeah. That's a good, and you put that together when, the furry Lent?
That was, I used to say it was December 29th, 1980. Oh, Furry Lint? No. But that tape of Garrett was either Christmas Eve, 1983, or December 29th, 1983. And I have to check my archive to see which I decided on. But that was put August 24th, 1988.
And did you do that for radio?
Yeah, CKLN. What happened was... Dave Neufeld he had been kicked off CKLN for conspiratorial reasons, and he was just starting to buy a computer and make computer music, because he was a musician, but he started to go into the computer thing, and then he goes on, you know, today he's part of Canadian music history, but he was, someone told me, hey, you can have Sunday night from 11 till 2, there's 3 hours if you want to go and do what you want. Some friend of mine had to give up the slot that night. So I called up Neufeld. I said, hey, bring some of your records, because he's a DJ. He was a DJ. And we'll just go on there, and I'll bring some tapes. And we just winged it, and it was the most magical night. It is incredible what we did that night.
Yeah, that's a cool – yeah, it is. It's a cool kind of – yeah.
It's archetypal now. You go back, a lot of the website memes or types that the web released, they're all there. Each one of those holy offices is an archetype, a way of looking at things. And we've got the best of all the different ways of looking at sociology or political stuff or whatever. It's all there. Mae Brussel, Zappa, McLuhan, Cosmic Awareness. Oh, which reminds me, so on Wednesday night tailgate, after we did Martin Luther King and Gurdjieff, after about the 10th hour, most of the people were running out of steam, so I thought, well, we got to get some new energy in here. So I said, oh, let me call Dave Worster, who's on Furry Lint, several parts of Furry Lint. He's the guy who blew up the space shuttle. Remember that part?
which one?
yeah, which one? No, it was January 86, and they stole his dog. He was living out in Lakeview, like in internal California. And they stole his dog, and he said he was going to make four moves on his chessboard, and somebody was going to lose $40 billion. And that's what happened. The space shuttle Challenger blew up, and that was a big expense for NASA or for somebody, for the government. And then we have Neufeld. Neufeld was running a news show at that point. He hasn't been laid fired yet. So we have Dave Worster come on to talk about it. And while we're talking about it on CKLN, about how he blew up the space shuttle, there's an earthquake in Toronto, which hardly ever happens. And that proved the point that whenever Worst and I get together on the phone after we haven't talked for a year or two, there will be an earthquake. And so it happened on the radio right there. And that should be on Furry Lint. I think that's on there. Anyways, then you have Worster later. What?
So that's crazy, Bob.
I know. And then later on Furry Lint, Worster is talking about living out there and how some black guy was chased down the street by the local residents and beat up. Do you remember? You probably don't remember that. But anyways, it's really good stuff. So I called up Dave Worster, who it was his birthday yesterday. He's 82 on May 23rd. And today is Dylan's birthday, in case you forgot.
I never knew.
Yeah, May 24th. So I call up Worster, and Worster has never interacted with Ion before, but he started it with Cosmic Awareness. He started this whole manifestation that I've created. And so he comes on, and it's really great. I definitely recommend it. Listen to Worster talking about the beginning of the universe in Rai terms. Very interesting. So that was a great thing. So why am I saying this? We're talking about Furry Lynn. So that reminded me of Worcester. So these are holy offices, but Garrett, and they're all memes. They all represent certain things that have been what I call Baroque spiraled into whole worlds with all, you know, you got a million websites on any theme, right?
Mm-hmm.
You take cooking, people talking cooking lessons. There must be a million websites on that.
Yeah, I just learned how to make a tuna fish salad the other day.
Who from?
Some site.
Oh, you watched? I thought a person. Okay, so we're talking about.
Well, it is a person that just put a recipe up there, but you know, back in the day, you'd have to go to the library and all that.
Right, right. And you're a bachelor now, so you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So okay, so the war wound comes out. War wound. You know that John Cleese skit when he's doing Fawlty Towers? Yeah, he's I think it's Fawlty Towers or Monty Python, but he's arguing with somebody and suddenly he gets this excruciating headache and he holds his hand up to his head and he's pressing it, he goes, War wound. So we just mentioned your bachelorhood. That's your war wound. You know, it's like a pain that comes back.
Yeah, and everyone's got one.
That's right, except for me. Right?
Really, you seem pretty happy, even though, you know, being behind all these pretty much every...
I distribute war wounds. Including AIDS. I'm the one who distributes war wounds. That's why I don't get any.
That's right. You created AIDS. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Well, I was part of the team. As a matter of fact, I'm going to try to quickly bring up the diary entry that does that. But while I'm doing that, we're talking about David Lynch, and we went into Garrett Dean, sounds like Ion, and the David Lynch. Is there anything you want to say about Lynch since we brought up these cassettes? Well, I'm waiting for him to – oh, yeah, so then he did these – I love those little vignettes. Okay, so someone following Dobstown, in one of those video vignettes, he talks about his friend who got busted by the police. Do you remember that story back in when they were making Eraserhead, like 1970? And I never remember. It's Philadelphia or Pittsburgh where he's hanging out there going to art school. Do you remember that, Lynch?
Philly. Yeah, it was Philly, yeah.
Philadelphia. And he talks about his friend gets busted for some reason by the cops. And he has to identify himself. Yes, he doesn't have his ID or something. So when they ask him who he is, he says Rumpelstiltskin. I think that's the story. But the punchline is Rumpelstiltskin. And so people who are into Bob Mize and Ockerny were amazed because Rumpelstiltskin is the pivot point on my chart, right? And so there's Lynch.
Yeah, you always talk about Rumpelstiltskin. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's Lynch. A key anecdote in his past, his dear personal private memory, is this whole Rumpelstiltskin. It's in his word. In his mind, and Rumpelstiltskin is what these guys are in. That devil guy in Lost Highway, Bob or Mike without the arm is like a Rumpelstiltskin. They're hijackers of the scene. Do you know what I mean? Like Rumpelstiltskin did.
Yeah. Yeah. Robert Blake's character was Rumpelstiltskin.
That's right. Yeah.
And then
Robert
he
Blake's
turned
character.
Into a real life Rumpelstiltskin.
That's right. That's right. And let's see, I'm just drawing this up. Okay, I've got the diary here. Let's see if I just put in AIDS. Does it? No, it's immune. Immune. Okay, I think. No, it's so it has to be South Africa, Zaire. I'm just doing the find thing, you know, finding the mm-hmm. diary entry. Oh, I know it's by date, so it's 1971. Just go up to the date. 1971, okay, August. Here it is. Here is the diary entry. This is the meeting I witnessed. This is in Lagos, Nigeria, May 11th, 1971. So this is the 39th anniversary. This is May 24th, right? So May 11th, 1971, Lagos, Nigeria. What I write is, the hot night is not being suffered by Bob, As he pondered the following words the scientist had just spoken, now quote, here's the words that I'm quoting. This is the guy who is proposing an AIDS kind of scenario. Since it's not feasible for us to have a nuclear war, yet we still may have to harness captive nations for industry, the way to conduct war is to find something that weakens the enemy so they can't fight and resist, but still leaves them alive enough to recover and work for us. I propose I can genetically engineer a virus that can weaken the immune system temporarily so the enemy picks up local diseases over a pre-programmed period of time, and then this vulnerability subsides. There it is, right there.
Wow.
Yeah, read it
again.
That
was you.
That was me at the Secret Council 10 meeting listening to a scientist proposing for military reasons a virus.
Okay.
Something that you would put in the population, they would temporarily have the weakened immune system, get the local diseases, get sick, you walk in, take over the country, and then the virus mutates and becomes benign after like 3 weeks, then the people get better, and you haven't killed them off, and then they can work in the factories for you. So you don't want to kill off bodies if you take over a country, you got to have them run the industrial infrastructure, right?
Yeah, right.
So this is the guy's, it was called a viral debilitant. So in Lagos, Nigeria, I'm there in this meeting, and I'm sitting there, and I say, the hot night is not being suffered by Bob, meaning me. I'm not suffering. Nothing happens to me, negative. The hot night is not being, it's a hot night, but it's not being suffered by Bob. As he pondered the following words the scientist had just spoken, then I give the words. Here's what the scientist had said. And, this is partly what Zappa ends his autobiography with. He ends his biography with a quote from a book, The Highest Form of Killing, came out about 1982. A quote from the documentation where some scientist is making a proposal to a Senate subcommittee about 1969, saying something like this, not exactly like this, but offering to develop immune weakening biological warfare agents. That's how Zappa ends his book. And I gave him that quote. He had found it, and then he lost it. And then he asked if I had it, and I said, yeah, and me and Jerry sent it to him. And that would be in October 88. Okay, so here it is. The scientist is saying to me and my committee that I was just a junior member back then, just a TA. I was just a teaching assistant in the international MK Ultra program. I was just a TA or an adjunct. Okay, he says, since it's not feasible for us to have a nuclear war, and yet we still may have to harness captive nations for industry, so considering that we might, as a nation, need to still have war agendas going on, capture nations, he says, the way to conduct war is to find something that weakens the enemy so they can't fight and resist, but still leaves them alive enough to recover and work for us. You get that? Something that weakens them.
Yeah.
Something that they ingest that weakens them. We don't
want to
kill them.
We
want to weaken them.
We want to be able to be productive.
But we have to weaken them temporarily. They collapse. Everybody, it's like the documentary Flash Forward. Everybody wipes out for, not the documentary, the TV science fiction thing, Flash Forward, where everybody wipes out for 2 minutes and has a flash forward to April 29th, which will be the finale is this week on Thursday night, Flash Forward. That and maybe one more week after. No, I don't know. Maybe it is the finale is this week. There's one or two shows left. It's a good show, but they're not renewing it. But it gets to the punchline where they arrive at the day that everybody flash forwarded it to 6 months before. So anyways, so this is everybody gets affected by the virus in the country you're attacking, and then they get so weak they can't resist. You take over, and then the virus goes away, and they're a bit healthy again, and they work for you. Okay, so it still leaves them alive enough to recover and work for us. I propose I can genetically engineer a virus that can weaken the immune system temporarily so the enemy picks up local diseases over a pre-programmed period of time, say 3 weeks, and then this vulnerability subsides. So that's why AIDS was put into Chad in Nigeria. See, that's why this meeting is in Lagos, Nigeria. It's in Nigeria and Chad area that the AIDS virus was planted behind the World Health Organization's smallpox vaccination program. It was sort of infiltrated into that in 79-80, mainly 1980, I think, and it went, the virus mutated beyond what we thought it would be, and it went for 29 years, which is about now. Right now is when the AIDS virus should be so, like a 24-hour cold. You know, the
well,
three-week...
Yeah, it's kind of like having diabetes. You know, if you maintain it, you live pretty much a decent life.
Right. And you know, back in the early 80s, it was very virulent, but it was programmed to weaken over time. It was programmed to weaken over a three-week period, but the scientists screwed up, and it didn't weaken until 29, you know, 20, 25, 29 years. So we're right in 29, this past 6 months, is the death of the AIDS virus. I had never had an opportunity to note that. I'd forgotten about that.
So that's another exclusive.
Yeah, another exclusive.
Again!
Well, if you have me on and you explore the vast world of Bob, you will have exclusives because so much stuff that hasn't been said before that can be said.
That people would have thought was impossible to be said.
That's right, and you're open enough and you know, allow anything that we can bring up, so it unloads more. It's like working with Ion. I'm kind of like a medium. You just ask it anything and you find out something. That's what I do with Ion. You can ask it anything and you'll get some really good information, no matter what it is. So you just make up topics almost.
But you're a much nicer guy these days.
Oh, well, I disbanded the Secret Council 10. Now, you can read. Well, okay, I shouldn't have flipped it up. I should read you. This is like a supplement to the reading the interview. It's reading the diary entries of what my father says to me. You know, see, he knew that the Secret Council 10 and the old Illuminati was going to become obsolete. So let me just see if I can find... I know in 63, there's a whole bunch of quotes starting in 1948 or so, and then you move up to the 50s, late 50s, and there's a sequence of quotes with my father where he's gradually talking about this, so telling me what he foresees, because he's higher up than me, you know, in the 1560s, but he knows that I'll move up the ranks, and he's preparing, and he's not sure whether he wants me to stay in the Secret Council 10. He says, this world is ridiculous. It's collapsing. It's not working. And I became a nicer guy. Well, I was a nice guy always, but I knew that I'd have to disband it. So let's see. Here's an interesting thing. Here, you look at this incredible stuff in these diaries. It tells you a lot. February 14th, 1961, in Washington. I'm sitting with J. Edgar Hoover. He says, those fools are going ahead with that Castro nonsense. This is like a few weeks after Kennedy's been inaugurated. I go, shit, so I'm going to have to go down to Miami? And Hoover says, not only that, you're going to have to visit the JM Wave Group. And later, many people thought the JM Wave Group was responsible for the Kennedy assassination. But I knew those people, and that's what I'm indicating there. Listen to this. Frank Zappa in 1962. I'm in Lancaster, where Zappa was hanging out. You know, he would spend his late teen high school years there. April 25th, 1962. Dobbs. It's written in diary form, or like a dialogue. Dobbs. Frank, how's the greeting card business over in Claremont? Zappa says, it's not music, but I got a hunch that what I'm learning about business, especially advertising, is going to help me be a better composer. Now, what do you think of that sentence? It's not music working. How's the greeting card business over in Claremont? And he says, it's not music, but, you know, everybody knew even then that he was addicted to being a musician. That's what he had to be. He says, it's not music, but I got a hunch that what I'm learning about business, especially advertising, is going to help me be a better composer.
And then
I said, do you think Don Vliet will learn as much in the shoe business? Because he was in selling shoes at that time. That's Captain Beefheart.
That's Captain
Beefheart, yeah. So I say to Zappa, do you think Don Vliet, for the people reading it so they know who I mean, but I probably didn't say Don's last name, right, in actuality, but just so you know who I'm talking about. Do you think Don Vliet will learn as much in the shoe business? Zappa laughed and turned on his tape recorder. And then I say, I met a genius the other day over – okay, so he turns on the tape recorder, but I don't know what he's recording. He's just recording us talking. See, I ask him a question about Don Vliet, and he turns on the tape recorder. That's his answer. Because he always had the tape recorder with him. And I go, I met a genius the other day over in Cucamonga. And Zappa goes, oh? And I say, his name is Paul Buff, and he has this amazing studio. It has the most advanced recording equipment I've ever seen, out here in the sticks, no less. I told him about you and Don. He says you're welcome to visit and look it over any time. So I told him, and I thought at that time I was introducing Frank to Paul Buff, the famous Cucamonga Studio Z. Do you know that part of Zappa's background, or life?
No, I have to say I'm not a huge I don't know much about Zappa at all.
Okay, well, so. Paul Buff was a genius engineer, and he had 4-track or whatever studio. No one else had it. And a lot of the surf music was recorded in that studio. Well, Zappa started hanging out there, and then he eventually bought it from Paul Buff. So anyways,
okay.
And, you know, many years later, I found Paul Buff, and Carolyn had given Jerry Fialka had given Carolyn a T-shirt that said, I know Paul Buff personally. And she had herself photographed in a fashion book in New York, like a book about the hot women of, this would be like 1998 or something, the hot women of New York City, or Sting's wife was in there, Connie was in there, and she has, there's two pictures of her, and one of them is, she's standing there by a bunch of TVs, broken old TVs piled up, and it says on her T-shirt, I know Paul Buff personally, because nobody knows who Paul Buff is, right, basically. So that was a joke.
Right.
But I found out on the internet where he was, so I called him up, and I told him this, and he loved it, and he went out and got the book and bought it just to see this picture of that T-shirt. I found out from him, I didn't know this, that he made those T-shirts back in the, you know, 60s. I know Paul Buff personally. It's like saying, I know Kurt Weller personally, and you made them. So anyway, he made them, and they got around, and Jerry was always picking up scraps, you know, working at Zappa's. So he got a copy. He had this T-shirt, and he gave it to Carolyn. There it is immortalized in this book. And so Buff went out and bought it because there was his T-shirt. You know, this would be 30 years later, sort of, 25, 30 years later, right there in a hot book out of New York. So that's and, you know, and I knew Paul, and it went way back. I hadn't seen him in 20 or 30 years, but since this period in Cucamonga. So I'm telling Zappa about Paul Buff's studio. So Zappa says, give me his address, and I'll go over tonight. And I go, and I said, sure, but if you keep that tape recorder running, you're going to owe me millions. So in other words, I'm predicting that he's getting on tape me, and I'm important, I'm significant, so he'll be able to make a lot of money off the tape he made of me, so that's what I mean. If you keep that tape recorder running, you're going to owe me millions. So I found out later that he actually kind of faked that he didn't know who he was. He actually had made contact with Buff already, which is pretty interesting about Zappa's personality. Yeah, I didn't find out until years later. I don't know who I was talking to, and they said, no, Frank, I know Frank was over there like a few months before that. You know, someone who was, I don't know if it was Motorhead or somebody. I knew Frank was over there at that studio before this date you're talking about, Bob. So it was just an afterthought many years later that why did Zappa, you know, just say, oh, give me his address, so I'll go over tonight. It's like Zappa was like that. He's taping you. He's very secretive or very – doesn't tell you much about what he's really thinking about. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, he's playing pink.
Yeah, or no, just being a trickster. No, he just studied the effect.
Rumpelstiltskin.
Yeah. You know, he could have – you know what? And Rumpelstiltskin, right. He could have forgotten, since it was all new to him, he could have forgotten at that moment. He didn't know who I was talking about. And then he goes over there, and, oh, I was already here. You know what I mean? Because it was just the beginning of his relationship with Buff. So he might have at that – I'm just reporting what he said. And he may have forgotten that he'd been at that studio or just wasn't strong in his mind and he didn't know who I was talking about. Okay, so anyways, that's that. Okay, this is my father talking to me July 7th, 1962 in Paris. Rene, he says, Bob, it's beginning to look like the Vatican's philosopher Thomas Aquinas, the angelic doctor, might have the last laugh. This is certainly what your friend and cutout McLuhan has placed his bets on. His use of Aquinas' own word medium is very clever. That McLuhan's use of Thomas Aquinas' own word medium is very clever. Even though the committee, that's the Secret Council 10, assigned you the job of monitoring McLuhan, he may prove extremely helpful in my plans for you. Although the committee will have to drop McLuhan eventually, he actually says drop him, I don't want you to lose touch with McLuhan and those of his colleagues who have a good understanding of him. So that was my father telling me to stay in touch with McLuhan. So then, here's on July 21st, 1962, I'm with McLuhan. And it says, as Bob and Marshall left the church, Bob couldn't hold back the question he kept to himself for the last couple of years. Dobbs, Mac, why do you go to Mass every day? And McLuhan says, the Mass is the secret behind everything I write about. The stages of apprehension which are replayed in the artistic creative process are also echoed in the Eucharist. These stages of apprehension are again mimed in the rituals of the collective social energies as shown in the popular phrase mass media. However, what we are living in today is a black mass that is eating us alive daily. So I have a responsibility every day to hold up the Catholic mass, to hold it up to our environment, just as the Holy Cross is used to ward off a vampire. So I say, so Christ took the simple act of sharing food, turning it into an art form, the cliché to archetype pattern, and parodied the secret cults and their magicians for all time. And McLuhan says, you got it, Bob. How's that? Thoughtful stuff, man.
It is. Now, were you sent to kind of like keep an eye on him, though?
Yeah, that was in 1954 because his journal, Explorations, the first issue, came out in December 53, and the first essay, the main essay by McLuhan in that journal, there was essays by other famous people, Robert Graves, other famous Aldous Huxley, though not Huxley, but people like that. Famous people were in the journal. And in it, he explains how the medium is the message. That's the cure. That's the cue and clue to how people who manage our society run the show. They don't care about the content. They know that people are controlled through the medium, the form itself, not the content. And that basic insight was a major rule and understanding in the Secret Council of Ten. And when somebody found out that this McLuhan professor was revealing this, I was in New York anyways and visiting Duchamp and friends of my father. And that's where I first saw Garrett in a club. That's when I first saw him. He just happened to be in the village. And I might read that little part. Anyways, this is fun doing the diaries. This is an untapped treasury here. So what was I saying?
The diaries, for anybody out there, the diaries are good reading.
Yeah, it's an education.
I printed up a nice little bound thing of those because that's good stuff.
Right. So what was I just saying?
One of your TAs or adjuncts re-chronicalized it. They put it in order.
Right, but what was I just talking about? I forget. I was talking about McLuhan, the mass. What was the side thing before I went off on the other side thing?
There was the Zappa thing about.
Right, and then I got into McLuhan.
And then Garrett, and I was meeting Garrett at a dance club.
Oh no! The Explorations Journal comes out. So here was McLuhan. I was already in New York, so they sent me up to Toronto in early '54 to find out who this professor was. How did he know? Why did he know this about the? The secret way of management, tetrad management, was the principle back then known as the medium is the message, not the content. It didn't matter. It wasn't about ideological propaganda anymore. It was just maintaining the speed of life by having the population watch TV 24/7 and just whack them out by being addicted to TV. And then all the social effects that would come from the tactile mosaic image of the television. So this kind of stuff McLuhan found out himself. And so when I met him in 54, this was my first anachrony. I found out that he got this stuff from Wyndham Lewis, who had McLuhan. Lewis was like McLuhan's personal mentor in the 1943-44 period in St. Louis, Missouri. And Lewis is the main guy that Joyce argues with in Finding His Wake. So Lewis, who wrote a book about the secret history of World War II, he told McLuhan all this stuff. And that's how he knew. And the anachrony for me was that I had met Wyndham Lewis when I was young because my father knew Wyndham Lewis. So here I am many years later, 20 years later, told to go find out how did this McLuhan know this stuff? And it turned out he knew my father's friend.
That's what. Now your father was what exactly? Rene Dobbs, the guy, the basically the he's basically the inspiration for the iconic Bob of the
right.
Stang's of the cargo cult church.
That's right. It's his image that I showed Stang and them in 78.
Now,
and see, he died.
What was his role? Was he part of the
He was a butler. My family were butlers for rich, one of the most rich people in the world, richest people in the world, not the richest, but part of that circle for 300 years. And so he, after World War One, the intelligence, the oligarchs were getting weakened. They couldn't control society. It was getting too industrialized. The collective effect of radio was happening. Communism was taking over. And so they couldn't rely on outside people to be their intelligence agents, so they started using my father and people within the family or in the local clan. So my father was brought into the intelligence work in the 20s, and then I was brought in 1944.
Okay.
Have you seen Inglourious Basterds?
Yeah.
That whole scene, that's 1944, it's like around the Battle of the Bulge time. It's not the end of the war, but it's getting close, right? And they try to kill Hitler.
Right.
Well, in the movie, they do kill Hitler. Well, when the Brad Pitt character, he and his buddies are with the Nazi out in the woods at the end, and they cut up the Nazi's forehead, right? The final thing. That reminded me of some of the diary entries here I could read you of that period when I was in the area of Malmedy. That reminded me of the scene I was part of in the 40s, and when I was brought in as a gopher, so to speak. Okay, so I want to just show you what Rene says to me in 64 or so. Okay.
So did you call him? Are you one of those kids that called your dad Rene, or did you call him Dad, or did you call him Papa?
No, I called him Rene. That was just the way it was, you know. Yeah, we didn't do Papa or Dad. Or things like that. It'd be because it's aristocratic. Aristocrats don't do that. And
you know, I thought the aristocrats say Papa.
No, that's Hollywood's distortion. You know, popularization of them, making them look human. Okay, on August 31st, 1964. Rene says to me, Bob, I don't think the committee realizes it's got only about 5 years left to definitively consolidate its interests. And even then, it's an iffy proposition whether consolidation or lockdown is possible. That is the last thing he tells me that I have here. And by then, I'm working with McLuhan and Zappa and promoting them and starting my own army in the media. So, like, I was working for hardware military establishments, that's the AIDS thing, and I was working for software establishments in the music business or in the pop culture business. That was all over the place. So I'm going to read you maybe one more Rene thing.
Okay.
Because I gave you the punchline, the last thing he said. Okay, that's going to take too long. So I'll go down here, 1958. No, maybe 53. 1952, May 18th, 1952, in Paris. My father says, Bob, I want you to think about the fact that when you see yourself on the television screen, your image is not reversed as it is in a regular mirror. When you look at the monitor of yourself in a TV studio, your image is not reversed like it is in a glass mirror.
Okay.
So he wanted me to think about that. And years later, I saw Alan Watts.
I never thought of that before.
It's very interesting. It shows you that the electricity is an organic, weird loop in relation to your optical nerve. And so Alan Watts, I heard almost 20 years later talking about that. He used to point that out. And then in January 1st, you know, 7 months later, January 5th, 53, my father says, Bob, this is going to be an interesting year. Stalin will be dead soon. The Korean War will soon be over. The world is going to be a different place politically. It's going to be more battle for men's minds rather than for territory. And I think a symptom has already surfaced. Do you remember Sandoz and their LSD-25? I go, yes, Dr. Albert Hoffman in particular. He says, yes, well, some people have surfaced and are complaining about how the CIA is misusing LSD as a truth serum for interrogation purposes. Interesting, isn't it? The mining of the subconscious for invisible patterns as a military operation. Joyce's Finnegan's Wake comes to mind. And I said, Finnegan's Wake always comes to your mind. I'm afraid I've heard too much about that book over the years from you and your friends for it to fascinate me. Well, I changed my view later on that. I'm now, people say that to me now. Finnegan's Wake always comes to your mind, Bob, right? So I'm now in the Rene position.
Yeah, that's, you mentioned Finnegan's Wake at least once every
show, right. Yeah, and I'm telling my father, this is almost 60 years ago, I'm afraid I've heard too much about that book over the years from you and your friends for it to fascinate me. Now, that's talk about eating crow, eh?
Yeah. That's so like, then, fuck you, Dad.
Yeah. Fuck that book. Fuck James Joyce. They're all a fucking bunch of fags. No offense to actual fags, since I'm a fag myself, but, you know, because I'm a fag, I can say fag, right?
You say fag like Eminem says fag, but he's still best friends with Elton John, so it's cool.
Yeah, what did you just say? I say fag like what?
You say fag like Eminem says fag. Like, he's best friends with Elton John, so it's kosher.
Oh, I didn't know that. He's teamed up with Elton John? How did that happen?
They did a song together, like, live, and then when Eminem was going through his addictions.
Divorce. Oh, addictions,
well,
okay.
And he was addicted to painkillers. He was, like, on the phone, like, quite frequently with Elton John.
He talked
so
him down.
Elton John's actually embraced Eminem.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. And that's years ago?
No, it's just recently, probably last few years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So on January 2nd, 53, the next day, after we talk about LSD and mind control, he says the next day, I think you should know, son, that we're going to give Herbert W. Armstrong and his church an outlet on Radio Luxembourg this year. This is the famous, you know, Worldwide Church of God, Plain Truth magazine.
Plain Truth, yeah. My grandparents used to get the Plain Truth, yeah.
Well, I'm reading you the diary of the guy, my father, who helped make Herbert Armstrong popular because they gave him an outlet on Radio Luxembourg in Europe. And so I say to my father, why would you do that? Why would you give him that thing? And he says, all the archetypes are allowed full expression from now on. Get that. All the archetypes are allowed full expression from now on. All the archetypes are all the media content. Because the media dynamics is what controls people, not the content. And the content become archetypes. And that's what your show, what I say at the beginning of Furry Lint. Me or Bob Marshall, we say, from cliche to archetype. That's at the beginning. That's right there. So all the holy offices become archetypal. Very profound.
Okay.
Here's the reason I got kicked out of Europe. January 9th, 53, I'm in Iran, in Tehran. Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, who was Prime Minister of Iran, says to me, Mr. Dobbs, it's getting harder for us to tolerate this embargo. You have been saying you can persuade the British that our compensation package is enough, but so far you have not been successful. I'm getting very reluctant to continue relying on your resources because the CIA was coming after him and we, the British, were propping him up. So I say to him, the British government is not able to control Alan Dulles and his CIA. Dulles is not willing to accept your administration, and they're going to try and put in the Shah. The British have their hands tied, so we will rely on our influences in Washington to tie Dulles' hands. The British will soon accept your package, and the Shah will remain in Rome. You can count on us, so you need not worry. Well, turned out I was fucking wrong, and I get nailed.
And they kicked your ass out.
Yeah, I was punished and sent to North America, which the European oligarchs or the Secret Council of Ten European faction did not consider a significant place. See, they didn't understand that America was going to become the American century, you know, starting after the Korean War. Europe still felt it was the center of the world, and who gives a damn about America? We suckered them into helping us during World War II, but it took a while for the average consciousness to accept, shit, Paris is not the capital anymore, and New York is. right, you know, of the world.
Paris still hasn't accepted that.
That's right. And so when I went to New York, that was really a great thing. I mean, I wouldn't be who I am today if I didn't screw up with Iran, because I got punished and sent to the boondocks, to the, you know, to the wilderness, and it was there that I blossomed, because America took over. I watched it do that, and even though I wasn't equipped at the beginning to understand it, many years hanging out with Zapp and McLuhan and all these people, I learned and got the best and caught up.
You're versatile, man.
Yeah, I'm versatile, and
you can be a top or a bottom.
That's right. Here it is. Here's where. What are you laughing at?
I mean, because earlier you said you were a fag, so I just thought I'd put in a fag term in there.
Okay, because versatile?
Yeah, you can be a top or a bottom. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, I didn't hear that. I didn't hear that.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
There you go.
That
went right by. On you, Bob. You know,
yeah, no, it's all right. No. So in December 30th, 1953, I'm now in New York.
I'm like Shakespeare. We do this show. It's we have to keep we throw those stupid puns in there once in a while to keep the people that don't get it. You gotta keep it funny.
That's right. So in December 30th, 1953, I've now been banned to North America. So I first go to New York because friends of my father are there, and it says I'm in a cafe on McDougal Street. The English language poured out of the mouth holding court. Much of it sculpting a tale about a Russian lady telling off Nazi officers in a concentration camp. Occasionally, its audience would purr, "Oh, Garrett." So here is my first experience of seeing Garrett. I don't know who he is. I'm in a cafe, and he's sort of performing, and he's telling this story, which years later I get on tape, the famous one of his friend, the Russian lady, telling off Nazi officers in a concentration camp. So I'll do it again. In a cafe on McDougal Street, the English language poured out of the mouth holding court. See, that's how I describe Garrett, a mouth holding court. Much of it sculpting a tale about a Russian lady telling off Nazi officers in a concentration camp. Occasionally, its audience would purr, "Oh, Garrett." Now, I got to take a break here for a second. Someone's at the door. Just a second.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay. We got 2 minutes left, so they might cut us off again.
But they might not.
But just to keep us on track, we were still going to talk about the Monjack Brittany Murphy thing.
Okay, go into it. Go into it. Who are they?
I don't want to cut you off, so I'm saying that we can do that for next week.
Okay, but I'll just finish up there. So as I'm listening to...
Yeah, so finish your thought now. Yeah, I don't want to interrupt this flow.
Yeah, so December 53 is when I first experienced this character named Garrett. I don't know anything about him. And I actually don't get involved with him until a few more years later when I'm up in Nova Scotia, and then I bump into him. And I said, "What are you doing up here?" And then we become friends. So as I'm listening to Garrett, it says, Bob thought of Paris, his father, Baron Rothschild, and Wyndham Lewis. Bob turned to Marcel Duchamp, asking, "Why not?" That's what I'm with Marcel Duchamp. He's hosting me there because he was a friend of my father's. And Marcel Duchamp says to me, "I'm going to protect my art from the 20th century, this plague of machinery." So he's beginning to think about making secret art. You know, he made that famous – no, he actually started making the – it's called Donné, or French for given. He starts that in 1946. And it doesn't get unveiled until 1968 when he dies. And he did it like from 1946 to 1966 at a museum in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh. So he's telling me what he's doing, even though I don't fully understand the implications. I go, "Why not?" And he says, "I'm going to protect my art from the 20th century, this plague of machinery." So there's a statement by Duchamp for the scholars. You know who Duchamp is.
Yeah, he did the toilet, right?
Yeah. Just looking, I just want to find some other statements. Forget it. I'm not going to do any more. So We are. Let's go into what is this? Who are these people? These significant people? Murphy or something?
Brittany Murphy was an actress, and she passed away in December. Much like Heath Ledger, she died like kind of mysteriously. They thought it was drug related. Turned out she had pneumonia. They found her in her Hollywood Hills home. And there was a certain kind of, a lot of people were suspicious of the husband, who was a screenwriter, who only wrote two films. He wrote one about the factory, called Factory Girl, about Edie Sedgwick.
I saw that.
Okay. Which, if you think about it, is a strange kind of synchronicity in that you can compare Edie Sedgwick to Brittany Murphy, because Brittany was only 31, I think, when she died. And I've been really now, the synchronicity thing. I've been obsessed with the Brittany Murphy death since it happened. And this last week, I kept talking about Simon to people. I was looking at pictures of the Simon guy, and I kept thinking, I want to talk to this guy. There's something about this guy. I want to know what the hell's going on here.
Is Simon the screenwriter husband? Is that who Simon
is?
Yes. Okay.
Yes, and I was just talking about it on Friday to a colleague. I'm saying I gotta get to the bottom of this. I have to figure out a way to contact Simon. You know, and I've been able to contact some people. You know, through the show and everything, and I've been getting, you know, more high-profile guests and stuff, so I'm not crazy here, you know, it's something I might be able to work out. I mean, I figured the odds were against me, but, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Suddenly, I did all these Twitter posts about Simon, and they're kind of poetic, you know. I've been doing Twitter lately because I'm trying to kind of it's 140 characters that you can post. So I've been trying to kind of craft these sentences that fit into that. It's kind of an exercise in sentence creation, in technique. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. No, good.
You see what I'm saying? Okay.
Yep.
So I've been doing a lot of stuff about Simon over the last 4 to 5 days. And then today I find out a friend of mine responds to one of my Twitter posts. She says, "It's strange now, isn't it, that he's dead too?"
Wow.
And that was the first I heard about it. So it's too late for me to get to the bottom of this. It's like, you know, I'm wondering if Brittany ever really truly died, or if she just, you know, switched over.
Well,
none
of these things are mysteries. You email me the details, and I'll find out from Ion.
Really? You do that for me?
Oh, yeah. I investigate anything with Ion. I'm always doing that. Anything that comes up, I'll find out what happened through Ion.
Okay, yeah. I will put together everything
just
I can
do a paragraph
find.
On her, who she was, and how she died, and the rumors about her. And then a little paragraph on Simon and what he did and the rumors about him and when he died.
And then you'll talk to Ion for me.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I get to the bottom of everything through these great mediums. That's how I became Secret Council 10 in the 80s, because chairman of Secret Council 10, because Prince Charles and Nelson Rockefeller, well, he was dead by then, but his leftovers, they wouldn't use the evergreens.
Ah, okay. But for the record, you didn't have her killed, right? You stopped doing that shit a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I did. I stopped. Basically, there's a couple old grudges.
Mom.
There was a couple of old grudges that later happened, but I had nothing to do. I basically have had nothing to do with anything since 2000. So I had nothing to do with September 11th. And
yeah, I knew that.
This.
I knew you denied 9/11. Yeah.
No, I did not do that. Though you can see glimmers of it in my chart, which is interesting.
Well, that chart is probably. Do you still have the original chart?
You mean the little sketchy stuff?
Like you know, like you said you built the chart like in your living room one day. I think.
Yeah.
We'll get back to the interview portion as well of the show,
yeah.
But you said you built.
No,
it
I don't have the original. I don't really have that original whiteboard that I pasted the little stickers on. No, I don't have
okay.
that. I didn't know it was going to be so important, I guess. I mean, I felt it was important, but I didn't know that, you know, whole nations would covet it in 20 years, that it would be sold at Sotheby's for $25 billion.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That'd be like, right, you know, you'd be out doing them Hitler, that Hitler auction they just did.
Yeah. No,
that chart would probably be worth more than all his shit combined.
What it? My chart?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. In the long run, it is. And anybody connected to Carol Dean will be worth billions. You know, that's the way it'll be. And that's a little subtle prediction there for you. But the, what was I going to say? Since I already was wealthy, I don't think in those terms. I don't think about, well, how can I make some money out of this? Oh, I better save it. I could sell it to Kurt in 10 years. You know, he'll buy it for $1,000 or something. You know, I'm not thinking that way.
Well, that's a good. That, you know, I don't think that way either, really. I'm in a right now. I'm in a spot where I'm comfortable, so I don't really care.
You got
about
slack.
That.
You got slack. You got total comprehensive slack. See, you only get slack from Stang, but you get comprehensive slack from Bob.
You almost get compulsory slack from Bob.
Yeah, that's right. It's you don't. You actually try to run from him. You get too much. So far they haven't knocked us off. This is good. We're going overtime. Let me read you. Here's a big hint.
I do have to say I do only have about 10 more minutes though. So if they
okay,
don't knock
right.
us off, I'll have to knock us off.
Okay, so we. We now want to go into the paralysis, your sleep
the
thing.
The sleep paralysis, yes. So on the plaza of the mind, I've been collecting stories of sleep paralysis from people all over the world in the hopes of creating a pamphlet on sleep paralysis.
Right. This is a feeling where you wake up and you can't move.
Right, like you can't move your body, but you're aware that you're conscious.
Yeah,
and
it's a horrible feeling.
You'll open your eyes, but you can't see anything, and yeah.
It's a horrible feeling. I hate it. I don't get it much. I've had it a few times years ago, but I haven't had it lately. But, you know, we don't even need to talk anymore about it. I'll ask Ion. He'll explain it.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Yeah, but just a little more detail. You're collecting stuff on it?
Yeah, I'm collecting just like regular people's stories on it. And, you know, I get a range of all kinds of, like, different people think it's religious. Some people give their scientific. But it's basically everybody who's responded, and there have been quite a few. I mean, at least a few dozen people have, like, written little anecdotal stories.
That's a good idea. That's a really good idea. That's a regular human phenomenon that you know, it'd be interesting to hear what people say about it. That's very good, Kurt. That's a valuable book.
Thank you. Yeah, because they you know, there's that famous painting of that demon that's he's sitting on the chest of this like virginal woman who's asleep. I don't know if you're seeing
Oh, yeah,
I
you mean
think...
the in the 19th century. Henri somebody.
Right. And
yeah,
that's kind of like his take on it.
That image is in, I know art largely, well, there's other ways, but one of my main art memories comes from McLuhan's book Through the Vanishing Point, where he goes through the whole history of art, and he has these paintings from all these eras. He has that painting in that book. And, like, it's a 19th century woman, like, draped over her back over the bed, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and there's this little like gremlin demon fucker
sitting on her. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's portraying for sleep paralysis. That's what it's supposed to be.
That's one of the interpretations I read. Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know exactly what was in the dude's head when he painted it, but that's kind of like the idea I got.
Yeah,
and if he didn't intend that, I know they've used it a lot for sleep paralysis.
Do you know the name of the painting? I don't think it's Henri somebody. I'm just trying to think. What do we call this?
I wish I did. I can't remember.
Yes, yeah, sleeping with demons sitting on her. Demons sitting on her. Sitting on her chest. See if that comes up. Demons that cause nightmares. Incubus. So I didn't put it.
Okay, here's the painting. Let's see. Let's see, I'm looking it up too. It's not telling me who the artist is. Yeah, they're calling it an incubus.
Oh, incubus, right? Yeah, so put in incubus and painting. See what happens there, incubus.
See, I thought an incubus fucks you, though.
Yeah, that's right. Henri Fuseli. It's called Nightmare.
Okay,
see,
there you go.
I was right. I knew it was Henri. So Henri Fuseli, F-U-S-E-L-I. Henri Fuseli. And it's called Nightmare, the Incubus. Maybe it's Nightmare, the Incubus, I think. So anyways, that reminded me of something. Okay, so we've got the paralysis idea. Great. Okay, we're finished with your puny ideas. Let's go back to my awesome diary.
What? Nah, come on, man.
Okay. You know why
puny,
I did that?
You did that
for
the subgeniuses.
Yeah, yeah. What I did, I was there, you know, saying, what a great idea. So I just thought, oh, shit, they're going to say, look at Bob sucking up to Kurt so he can get another hour on their anonymous blog. So I knew they'd start to think I was sucking up to you. So I had to invert the hierarchy by saying, insulting you and get back on proper perspective. Okay.
I see your tricks.
Yeah. So September 29th, 1954 in Washington, the diary says, J. Edgar Hoover screamed at Bob and his partner. Here's what he screamed.
All right. Hold on. I'll allow you one more.
Okay. Well, this is a good one. This is a
okay.
Key one.
Beautiful.
J. Edgar Hoover is screaming, they've nailed McCarthy, and now the Catholics are going to run roughshod over us all. And then has me saying, yeah, this Joker McLuhan is a Catholic. That's in 1954, just after I met McLuhan and started my surveillance of him. J. Edgar Hoover's going, they've nailed McCarthy, and now the Catholics are going to run roughshod over us all. And I go, yeah, this Joker McLuhan's a Catholic. And that is the key.
That.
What?
I remember reading that.
Yeah, that's the key to the Kennedy assassination.
Wait, so that's the key. Somewhere in there, what you just said has the key to the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, yeah, it was not even in there. It's just blatantly right there. Remember, Kennedy was a Catholic. And Jay,
so
are you there?
Did, yeah, I'm thinking about what this means.
Well, I don't know
what the hell you're trying to say. So
look,
J. Edgar Hoover
is pissed that McCarthy got knocked out, and he sees it's a conspiracy by the Catholics to take over American government. So he says, pretty soon the Catholics will be running roughshod over us all. And then I say, yeah, McLuhan's a Catholic. So it's this anti-Catholic thing that J. Edgar Hoover is saying.
I see.
And JFK was a Catholic, and he became president. You know, J. Edgar Hoover's worst nightmare.
So Hoover dressed up like Marilyn Monroe. Now I'm just fucking with you.
No, that's good. No, that's okay.
Hoover. What I'm inferring from what you're saying is Hoover basically had to take care of that threat.
Yes.
So instead of whacking McLuhan, he whacked Kennedy.
Yeah. He had me whack McLuhan. And you know how we whacked McLuhan?
You planted the seed, though.
No, it was his personal vendetta against the Catholics. See, Hoover had that. That was his obsession. But what happened is that I whacked McLuhan by making McLuhan famous, and then everybody was pissed at this academic. He lost his cachet in academia by mixing it up with Time magazine. You know, back then, academia.
Oh, I see. You, because the academics can't. Yeah, once it's like Stephen King.
Yeah.
It'd be no respect.
That's right.
He's not obscure anymore. So therefore, fuck him.
Yeah.
Okay. See,
so
I learned something today.
Yeah. Now, I had to do that for my employers at the Sea Council 10, but I had another agenda because my father was showing me how the Sea Council 10 couldn't control this effect, and McLuhan would have effects beyond just being popular. See, the Secret Council 10 was a little old-fashioned. They're still thinking in literacy values, and they think the academia is a big deal. They don't know the information environment is going to take over, and anybody's a consultant to anybody. And it's not just everybody, you know, free-for-all trying to get on Johnny Carson or Charlie Rose or some show, C-SPAN, and get known for being a consultant or try to be a consultant. That was not foreseen by the Secret Council 10. So they thought it would be, we will kill this McLuhan by just having him get on a TV interview or something. They didn't know that actually McLuhan actually got stronger, more powerful, way beyond the patina of literate sophistication or highbrow art. And that's where I took advantage of what I had to do for McLuhan, fit the bill for my employers, but I knew it would have effects beyond what the employers imagined, and that that my revolution would bypass the Illuminati.
Okay, what do you think of Marguerite Oswald's theory that her son assassinated Kennedy as a mercy killing?
No. Lee Harvey Oswald was only. No, Lee Harvey Oswald was there to shoot. I mean, he was told to shoot in Chicago and Miami, and miss. And so he did that. He shot and missed. He never thought that Kennedy would be killed. So he was indifferent to the fate of JFK. He was shocked when
the fall.
Yeah, no, he was shocked when Kennedy actually got shot and killed.
Right.
And then he knew, and then when he got captured in the cinema, he knew he was being framed.
They knew he was screwed.
Yeah, so he did not go in there to get Kennedy. He was just doing his job and saying, fire warning shots at Kennedy. And this was in Chicago and Miami. And don't – I think the Chicago one got stopped, aborted. Somebody found out about it. But he was positioned to shoot, and he did shoot, I think, in Miami, and which is outlined, that whole setup is outlined in James Leroy's book, American Graffiti, which is a really good book. You ever read that? Not American Graffiti, American Tabloid.
No, I haven't.
I really recommend that, James Elroy, American Tabloid. They've made many movies out of his books about L.A. I can't remember the titles. But anyways, this scenario of Oswald was he didn't know whether the people who were employing him wanted to kill Kennedy, because he was told just to fire and miss Kennedy and warn Kennedy, like intimidate him. And so when he got shot, he was surprised. So he did not have a personal agenda against Kennedy.
Ah, okay. All right.
So, she's wrong.
Okay, well, she sounds like a nutcase. I just picked up one of a paperback about her because when I read on the back that she said that it was a mercy killing, that just cracked me up so much that I had to. I thought this.
You mean it was a mercy killing? It was a mercy in a sense that Oswald knew he had a sore back and was in agony over the affair with Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. So like,
it's a sympathy killing.
Right. So he's like a hero. He should be like giving him the Congressional Medal of Honor and shit like that.
It was his form of popular surgery.
Right.
Well, you know, we learned from Ion, every death is a suicide. So if you accept that point, JFK was going, he decided to go out, and he lined up with people who were pissed off at him and had other reasons to get rid of him. So everybody was happy. They got rid of him for his terms, and he wanted to get the hell out of it because he was sick of working for his father, and he had sore back and a lot of health problems, and just he was in real agony, and he had no power. Now, we're ending the show with big stuff here. Had no power because he'd been told in February 61 or 62 that the America was bankrupt and that China owned America.
Well,
yeah,
hey,
that's 50
let's
years
end
ago.
It on that. Let's end it on that because I gotta hit the road. But
okay,
as always, it's been a pleasure, Bob. I'll email you that stuff about Brittany Murphy. And,
no problem.
And then next episode we can talk about Lost, and maybe the Brittany thing.
Yeah, that's gonna be fun. And also, do you watch 24?
No, I've not seen that.
Well, watch it Monday night. It's the finale.
Oh, okay.
It's the finale Monday night, and then it's the finale of Flash Forward on next Thursday. No, what's today? In Thursday coming up, it'll be the finale of Flash Forward. The next, oh, no, tonight. Tonight is the finale of 24. Tonight.
Ah, shit.
Are you working tonight? Well,
no,
can
but
get
I got
your,
some other business.
Call a friend and tell him to tape it.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, so 24 tonight. Yeah, 24 tonight. Fringe finale is Thursday night and Flash Forward Thursday night. So a big week this week. And then we can talk about all that and how they intertwine with Lost.
Okay.
Okay.
God
talk
bless.
To you later, Kirk.
We'll talk to you later, Bob. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Kind of an eternity, Doug.